This is the KPTZ Compass, your local news magazine for the Northeast Olympic Peninsula. This week on the Compass, the pursuit of strange noises through the woods turns into a tour of Port Townsend's spanking new water treatment facility. So now, let's go inside the Compass. Coming through the forest sounded like something out of Jurassic Park, the giant footfalls of an apatosaurus, perhaps, and I just had to find out what was going on up at the top of the hill behind my house, where for the past year and a half I've been watching as men in trucks, hard hats, and bright orange vests turn the woods next to the water reservoir tanks and cell tower into Port Townsend's spanking new $23 million state-of-the-art water treatment plant, constructed by order of the State Department of Health to address the rising resistance of the cryptosporidium parasite to the old basic chlorine treatment. I grabbed my recorder and cut across my neighbor's property on an overgrown trail, soaking my feet in an ephemeral stream never seen before this winter on the way, and as I rounded the copse of woods at the top of the hill, I saw it, a huge piece of heavy equipment with an articulated arm several stories high and a vicious-looking claw that was tearing away the side of the old 5-million-gallon concrete reservoir tank that has now been replaced with a modern version that meets the most stringent seismic standards, unlike the old one. I knocked on the door of the project office trailer, and soon found myself face-to-face with project manager Rob Bromstad, a large, congenial man who, after making a phone call to obtain the necessary permission, agreed to give me a tour of the new plant. He gave me a hard hat, orange vest, and safety goggles of my own to wear, and we started out standing on the trailer's stoop, watching the giant machine rip chunks of concrete and snakes of steel from the side of the doomed tank.
It will be maybe a couple of weeks we'll actually be pulling it down a jaw at a time. It's called the long arm excavator, and we're trying to open up a hole so we can get inside, then we'll take most of it down inside. We're not taking the slab out. The slab will be for the future storage area, that kind of thing, so we'll have a good out of the dirt concrete pad to store things on. It'll just be the walls and the roof.
So now, is this the main reservoir, the former main reservoir for
this
the city?
This wasn't designed for earthquakes.
But there does appear to be a fair amount of rebar in there.
Oh yeah, it was pre-stressed, and but the overall design was not to handle an earthquake. It was to handle the water that's inside.
Now, last summer, I heard a steady whine for like several weeks in a row as you wound the new steel around the new tank.
Right.
So how much more steel is in the new tank than the old, you know?
Well, it's a whole different process. It's a specialized tank that's specifically designed for earthquakes. It's a high-tension steel cable that's wrapped at 15,000 pounds per square inch. And the machine, I don't know if you saw the machine.
I did. I came up here and looked at it.
Okay. It just goes round and round. And then they put a shotcrete over the top to protect it. So the new tank is now operational. That's why we're pulling the old tank.
Is it the same capacity?
Yes.
They look about the same size. Now, what is this big green tank here?
Well, the big tank is called the standpipe. And that's for higher elevations in the city. As you can see, that's 85 feet high. These tanks are 40 feet high.
But it's considerably narrower.
So this handles area like Sims Way, the higher elevation of the city, to make sure they have the water pressure.
And this is staying in place.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's basically a steel tank, right?
Yeah, it's a steel tank.
It's held to the ground by great big bolts, I see.
Yeah, it's designed for earthquakes. So,
Let's go look at the new facility.
It's the new tank, and it's all it's 5 million gallons. Water level in it's about 37 feet, and I think we're at 292 feet here. So that's I believe we're the highest point in the city, and that's why this area was chosen. While the cell towers are here as well.
You know, even though I live right beneath this, I don't know what the name of this hill is. Does this hill have a name?
I'm not aware of it, if it does, but...
The highest point in Port Townsend has no name.
Yeah, we'll have to go with that for now. So, we'll have to go in this side door right now.
So, how many contractors and subcontractors and laborers worked on this over how many man hours? Do you have any handle on those sorts of statistics?
I don't. There were five significant contracts involved here, and probably another four or five significant subcontractors involved. The filter equipment itself was pre-purchased because of the delivery time so that it would be here when the other contractors went to work. And so that's one contractor, Evoqua out of Massachusetts, was the contractor for all the filters and a lot of the filter equipment, the chemical. It's their process. Stellar J Construction is the general contractor here. HDR is the engineer that we interface with. MTC is a testing contractor that service that we work with. I know I'm forgetting somebody, but maybe on a large day we'd probably have 20 to 30 people on site working.
And it was your job to coordinate those 20 to 30 people and make sure that those various contractors, started their work and had their work finished by, certain dates.
And make sure the different parts, the engineer was coordinated with the equipment supplier, was coordinated with the subs when they wanted to come on. Assess the work itself, that it met the standards that we needed, the quality standards. Assess the construction itself in completion. So there's a monthly payment that has to go out, but that has to be, pay for what's in place. So you need to assess actually what's here, what's to be paid for.
And how did you do in terms of meeting schedule and budget?
I think we've come along pretty well. We pretty well hit the time to go on. There were some design issues back in November, December, on working with a potential water hammer back in the pipes that we had to work with some of the control valves to get out. That extended us probably a month or so beyond. But as far as bringing the water online, we pretty well hit where we needed to be.
Which was the beginning of this year or something, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Originally it was in the November time frame, I believe, and then it pushed it back. By the time we got the modifications made to valves and to pick up the water hammer, I guess, which you could call it, anyway, back into the pipes, it extended it on out a month or so. Anyway, so we got that all worked out, and that's all online, and everything seems to be working.
Remind me, how long did it take to build this?
We started the summer of 2015 with bringing in site utilities. I think our first equipment on the site was July of that time frame. The plant contractor came online in September. Probably didn't really get active till October of 2015.
So really under a year and a half, or so.
A strong year and a half, yeah, that's where we're at now. So, and a few things to close out. We've got a pump station to finish up should be online here in another couple of months.
So now you tell me that you had retired when you became the manager of this project. How did that happen?
Well, I'd reached an age when I thought it was time to retire and come to Port Townsend. I came out of San Francisco.
Where you had been a...
I'd been a project manager and been involved in a number of large projects down there.
Water plants?
Water, wastewater, airports, pipelines, and miscellaneous other projects, yeah. I was with a fairly large design construction firm.
And what kind of training leads you up to becoming a project manager for such a large project?
Well, I was a civil engineer, and then I went into construction management. I got a master's in construction management, and I've spent my life in construction.
Okay, so we've entered into the new facility here, and what are we looking at right here?
This is a pumps to provide pressure here at the plant. Those tanks only being, 85 feet high means that we would have minimum pressure here at the plant, so we have to boost the pressure for the plant itself.
I see.
But of course, by the time it rolls downhill to the homes and that, you gain that elevation, and so you have higher pressure at the homes. But the plant is fairly low pressure without the booster pump. So basically here, the 24-inch pipe that brought water into the reservoirs originally came up that road, and you can see we tapped in a vault there right behind that truck where we've brought a water feed over into the plant, and that enters over here. This is the water coming into the plant, and it goes through some barrel-type filters, automatic filters that take any big things out of it that we don't want to get into our fine filters.
What kind of filtration materials are in there? Is it charcoal? Is it sand?
No. These are steel.
Steel mesh?
Steel mesh, yeah. And there's a scraper that scrapes the stuff off.
I see.
And now they're not as noisy. So, and there's two of them. Everything's in pairs, so we've got a backup.
I see. So it only goes through one of them at a time?
Yeah.
Is that right? I see.
Yeah. Each has the capacity to take the full plant flow.
In normal operation, do you need to open these up and clean out the filtration material, or is
no,
it sort
there's
of
automatic. There's an automatic wiper on the screens that takes it and discharges it into our sewer.
So now this is a different and new method of purifying the water here. That's the reason for this plant being built, right?
Yes.
It used to be just chlorinated, right?
Yes, it was just straight out of the reservoirs off the watershed over in the Olympic Mountains.
Right.
And
that did not happen up here. That chlorination happened somewhere else.
That
right?
happened back at City Lake before it came down the line. So there should be some savings in chlorine, too, in that we're not chlorinating the same volume of water.
But now it's being purified using ultraviolet technique or something? Is that?
Some places, but that wasn't adequate for us. We looked at that. We started with sand filters, and then we went to ultraviolet possibilities, and now we're in ultrafiltration mode.
So these are preliminary filters here?
Yeah, these are just preliminary to keep the bigger stuff off the fine filters.
What are the fine filters made of? How do they work?
Well, let me show you over here. Anyway, this is the initial feed. We've got a little example here that we call a mushroom.
So are these the filters, these racks of vertical pipes here?
Yes. Yeah, we have three of them. If we go all out, typically the city uses about 1 million gallons per day during the summer. During the winter, we're down to maybe 0.5 to 0.75 million gallons per day. There's room here for expansion. Under strong conditions, we can go up to almost 3 million gallons per day.
So that allows for some growth in the city.
Yes, and also backup if we have troubles with one of the filter, we've got other backup filters to go to. And this is what's inside one of those columns out there.
Okay, describe
these
this for me.
These are the filters themselves. Very fine They can take particles out to 0.04 microns.
What are these made of?
It's a big, long name. Essentially, it's a poly.
It's a polymer, a plastic.
It's about the size of a human hair. The water comes up through the column, and then it transfers by pressure drop into, there's a tube actually inside. These are all tubes. By the tube, I mean these fine
hair-like
things.
Right, so these are sort of microtubes.
They're an ultra-fine filtration.
So days, weeks, and then years pass, and all this water is passing through all of these tubes. And
yes.
I imagine that these tubes need to be replaced at a certain point because they become
so... can monitor them. We've got instruments in that through our various processes that tell us when we have certain breakdown of the tubes, if we do. But what we also have, though, is we clean these tubes every hour with air. We throw air back into them and flush anything that's caught on them back out.
Really?
And then we go through a clean with hypochlorite occasionally that goes ahead and shocks out any organics and that are on the system. And then about every 45 days or so, we do what we call a clean in place, where we actually feed sulfuric acid and citric acid back through the filters to knock off anything.
And none of that acid ever gets into the drinking water.
No, we put it into a... there's 21 valves on each filter that control the various processes that these filters have of either water coming into the tubes or chemicals being introduced into the tubes, pushing them out the other way. And any of the waste material, they're completely flushed and blown out, goes into this large tank here where we neutralize it. And from there it goes into the city sewer system. But like anything that is used to clean off the filters is piped over the top and comes into this big tank here. And we have circulating pumps with instrumentation that tells us, you know, when we're hitting the pH we want and temperatures and things. And then at some point we can tell it to go ahead and dump into the sewer. We control the dump so it doesn't all go surging down there.
So the city sewer comes up here to the top of the hill?
Yeah, we put that in as a preliminary step before we started building the plant. We also put in... Those are a little noisy. Step outside, but coming down Rainier Street and then on up to the plant, we put in a new water line and also a sewer up here, and also a conduit for electrical and for telephone cable, those kinds of things. So we fed utilities up here that are all new.
So did there have to be any alterations to the city sewer system and the water treatment down there in order to deal with the new load coming from up here? Because
no, it isn't that big of a load, and it just filters in slowly. Yeah, there's a big tank over the edge of the hill there that catches it and then slowly feeds it on down.
And by the time you've neutralized it in that tank over there, there's nothing like particularly acidic or toxic about it, right?
Nothing that the plant downstream, you know, is worried or interested in.
I see.
Yeah, we've monitored it. We've actually been operating here since January 17th, and we did some trial runs before that, so we have a pretty good feel for the process now.
What were you looking for in those trial runs?
Well, just tested out before we went actually into the city system. We had to make sure everything's fine-tuned, and that and the state had to give us a final approval.
Were there any adjustments that came to light that you had to make before you could go online permanently in January 17th?
Oh, there's always tweaking, you know, fine-tuning things. Nothing of significance that was unexpected. You know, you got to make sure that the controls are all set up, the instrumentation, you know, that they're reading right at the right place. There's a lot of electronics involved here. A lot of feed out to the operators where they can control things over their iPhones. So, as you can see, there's an awful lot of equipment involved in that. This is the where we have both compressed air. All our valves are fed off of compressed air. You can see like valves there, the tubes and that. And then we have blower air, and they can supplement each other. But the blower air is low pressure air, and that's what we blow back through the tubes.
So the high pressure was for what again?
For the valves, and then also there is a high pressure a hit on some of the tubes sometimes. Use the higher pressure air to push the water and chemicals, whatever, out of the tubes, out of the thing. We actually push them out with air and blow it out and goes over into the tank here. That doesn't happen that often, but anyway, this is basically where our air is generated. That's more instrumentation that measures any particles coming in, you know, so we know what we're receiving. We also do temperatures. We also do chlorine analysis, going out, make sure our chlorine's working well. And this is our hypochlorite room, basically bleach that we feed on into the system.
This is where the chlorination happens.
Well, this is where the pumps feed it into the, yeah. But this is the pump that feeds it. See, it goes, comes out of the tank over there, feeds through this little tube, and it's very tightly controlled. We can, well, this one's actually working. We can actually
see that.
And so that just kind of takes a wheel and pushes it along through the tube. So we have two control areas. Well, I could show you one.
Yeah, I'd like to see that.
Before we go over there, I'll show you this. This is the chemicals here. And I say very low usage, actually. Everything's, you know, really fine-tuned, and it's you don't want to spend money on chemicals. So it's all, you know, every 45, 90 days we do a chemical wash, but it takes very little chemicals in those little tubes to flush through.
So it looks like you've got, so I see sulfuric acid, a couple of like 55-gallon tanks of that, and what's in the, this one is sodium hypochlorite.
Yeah.
And what are the two larger tanks?
We've got bases and acids so that we can control back and forth. That's how we knock down the citric acid and sulfuric acid. We got sodium bisulfite, sodium hypochlorite. Your sodium hypochlorite's basically bleach, just, well, it is bleach as you buy, except for it's not as dilute as you buy down in the store. It's about 10 times stronger.
Well, I have to remark that everything looks really tidy and clean and fresh and new in here, but I guess that's because it is.
Yes. So, the control panels. This is the control panel that you can, it's got a touch screen on it, and you can actually control everything right here.
So I'm just looking at a simple, 17-inch computer screen here.
Yeah.
And then like below that is a big orange button that says emergency stop, yeah, which you do just by doing that.
But don't.
Don't.
But so if you had to for some reason, I can't think of a situation you'd have to throw an emergency stop on it. But anyway, and each unit here is displayed, you know, what's going on, shows the resistance in the tubes. That's the way you know when they're starting to build up and might need to be flushed.
I see.
When things collect on the outside. Here it tells you the feed flows today. We've done, what, 600... about 600,000 gallons were processed today. Yesterday, we did 1.2 million gallons.
That's a big day for this time of year, isn't it?
Well, we're warming up. People are out doing gardening and that, yeah. It, you know, it could be that the tanks were, we draw the tanks up and down a little bit. There's a little fluctuation, so it may not be a constant feed over there.
Now, what happens in a power outage?
We have an emergency generator out here that kicks on, and go through there. This is the power room where the electrical power comes in. Yeah, we've got an emergency generator here that'll run the plant for 3 days.
being out on the peninsula, we needed a little extra fuel to make sure that we could keep going out here.
For 3 days. And
well, there's
really...
we got 5 million gallons in there, and we've got another million gallons in the standpipe, so we're set up to carry water for a while, yes.
So in a sort of like worst case disaster scenario, like, you know, the big earthquake and tsunami, after 3 days, if the power's not restored...
Or four or five or six, depending when we get down to the bottom of the reservoirs, yeah.
There's also the supply system, I suppose. There's a possibility of a rupture in that line, or is that...
Yeah, although underground piping doesn't seem to be quite as sensitive unless it's right in the quake area. I mean, it's pretty well boxed in. And the plant itself, we've taken, I can show you, we've taken extra effort. Actually, we've designed systems to withstand earthquake. All of our electrical cables and cableways, you can see, are extra braced there. That's designed bracing for seismic events. All the pipe supports are designed to handle seismic events. So you can see different anchors and supports on the different pipe systems. So we've tried to harden in the plant. You know, that we've had engineers actually do the design on these to resist certain earthquake forces. So
the plant is now basically complete, although I see that there's still, you know, various work going sort of on around the perimeter, a fence going in.
Clean up. We're producing water. But yeah, we still have paving. We've got some landscaping to restore the site. We've got a security fence to go in. We're doing just, you know, getting some grading back in. Just minor miscellaneous things.
Where's all the rubble from the old tank going to go?
They have to go to an approved site. They've got two sites that they're considering. They haven't locked that in yet, but there's possibility Bremerton site down there. There's possibility locally here. Seton might take some. They've handled some concrete before.
Is it basically going to get landfilled, or is it going to get put to some other use?
I don't know. We've made use of some of Seton's crushed concrete to stabilize some of our roads. So it just depends on what the end user wants to do with it.
With Port Townsend Water Treatment Facility construction manager Rob Wamstad, this is Steve Evans reporting for KPTZ Community Radio News. This week's KPTZ Compass was written and produced by Steve Evans. The Compass airs Mondays and Saturdays at noon, Tuesdays at 5 p.m., and Wednesdays at 10 a.m., exclusively here on KPTZ, the home of eclectic, authentic community radio. You can listen to podcasts of past Compass programs at the kptz.org website, where you can also stream KPTZ live 24 hours a day. For the news team here at KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, I'm Steve Evans.